This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 26 for Thursday, September 24th, 2009, Lulliet's Lessons. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store. Welcome to another edition of Out of Line After Hours. We got a great show tonight. Joining us, as always, David Welch from Business Week Magazine. Great having you here, David.
Thank you, John.
Also joining us tonight is Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production Magazine. Great having you here, too, yep. Gary. And we got Tim Lulliet, the chairman of Dura Automotive, and a whole string of other companies and all kinds of background in this out of business. But it's terrific having you here with us.
Good to be here. Good to see you again, John. And you guys.
So run through a little bit of your background. You're at Dura right now. You were at Metaldyne before that. You were at ITT.
You missed a couple steps. I mean, Okay. Basically, I started Ford, left with my team, went to AMC.
Which is where I first met you. You were a product planner at American Motors.
Ran product planning at
AMC. Working on the Jeep Cherokee at the time.
The Jeep Cherokee. We had $150 million to do a two-door, a four-door, a pickup truck, and a four-cylinder engine. The last line of development was done by the customer because we just didn't have any money. and then went to Bendix and then got in the supplier business. And then business was bought by Siemens. And then I went to ITT to run that group and tried to buy it. And it didn't work out with Mitt Romney to finance it. And then went with Roger Penske for years when he was had his health problems, and then got in business for myself, and then the Metaldyne sold it, and then went to retirement for 6 months and got into Dura a year ago.
Cool. Just wanted to have you talk a little bit about that in case people who are watching or listening right now weren't sure who you are or what you've done, but you've got real bona fides in this business.
Yeah. Well,
you've cut your teeth on a few companies here.
A few.
What do you think about Penske going to have, you know, is half as many brands as General Motors pretty soon? Isn't that...
Yeah, but I mean, the point is, you know, Roger has got quite a market share in some very key products in Toyota and Mercedes and some of the others. He's got a great network of vehicles. The Saturn situation to me is a great deal where he got some of the best locations and some of the best dealers in the country. They may not necessarily be in Saturn product in a few months, but the locations and the talent that's in those dealerships is superb.
What do you think they're going to sell there?
Well, he can move some of his other brands. But, you know, into those stores. But he also is now starting to source globally. So I think there's going to be some excitement coming out of that over the next year or two that's going to be interesting. And it's more, I think, a very more youthful, focused array of product coming out of there. So I think, and he's got some smart cars he can backload in there. So I think there's some interesting things coming there.
So the brand will stay Saturn, at least for part of
you know,
what he does?
Or not knowing what he's going to do, but I think the Saturn brand's got legs. But the dealerships have greater legs.
Yeah.
So the point is, what do you want to do with those points? Maybe they stay Saturn. Somebody could be a BMW point, could be a Toyota point, could be a Lexus point. Great points, great leadership in those dealerships.
So. Yeah, and they're all relatively really made new. Sure that they got the best of the best when they set up the Saturn
exactly.
franchise. They did it right.
Exactly.
The points are relatively new, so it's not like GM's older brands where they're, you know, they've got this initiative where they're trying to get some of their dealers for their more, you know, their older, more mature brands to move into better areas within a market and that sort of thing. You have to do anything with
them. No, these are already there. You know, look at the brick and mortar is not that old anyplace. I mean, it's. I think that was a great opportunity. The issue is people saw it as a Saturn buy. What it is, it's a retail buy. And let's see where it goes.
But do you think some of his other customers, like you mentioned, he's got Cadillac stores, he's got Toyota stores, he's got all kinds of stores as part of the Penske Automotive Group. Are these OEMs going to be saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, do we really want this guy also being a competitor of ours?
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, this business is about making money. And Roger sells vehicles. And when people buy a vehicle from any of Roger's dealerships, they come away happy. And therefore, you live with that issue. I mean, he's lived for years by selling Lexus and Mercedes, and it's worked rather well. Now, the last time I checked, and my database is maybe a little old, he was over 80% non-big three in the U.S., so he had quite an array of OEMs. And you sell vehicles for them, and the customer walks away happy, that's fine. I've seen customers go into stores, get some service done, And the service manager looks down and sees that their floor mat's frayed and just puts a new one in and doesn't charge them. That's the kind of policy that makes people come back for more. Mm-hmm. And so every OEM ought to be happy to have Rogers there.
We've seen the way he changed car racing with the meticulous eye for detail and making sure everything was clean and, you know, going to his transporters and every tool was in its place and just sparkling. And, you know, is he going to bring that to the Saturn franchise? And which leads to the second question, that with your experience internationally, do you think he'll be able to source cars from other makes that he can bring into this country and then sell to his high levels of...
First of all, everything he touches will be clean. There's no question about it. It's going to be the best dressed and best looking locations. And can he reach out already? You know, he's got a good network in Brazil. He's got a good network in Europe. No matter where Roger goes, and again, being a big Toyota dealer, on any continent, people want to do business with Roger. You know, he and I were involved in a couple of deals, and there were times when I thought that we probably could put a little bit more money on our side of the table than the others, and he always said, you know, we may want to do business with those people again. Let's make this win-win. And so given that kind of style, whatever he wants and whoever he wants, you know, whatever product he wants to source, I'm sure he's going to be able to get a deal done.
But Timmy, if you're GM, would you have sold Saturn to Roger or would you just have closed it down?
I mean, money's money. I mean, there was...
Yeah, but how much are they going to get for that? Compared, I mean, you know, if they get $100 million, it's a drop in the bucket for the kind of money GM needs to, you know, get out of government ownership and that sort of thing.
Well, a lot of these things, remember, it was a very transitory state at the time. Was Opel still going to be part of GM or not? A lot of this product comes out of Opel, you know, so therefore, you know, it was at least a fixed cost coverage. And even for the U.S., there is for a while some fixed cost coverage. And so, you know, I think everyone's kind of hedging their bets. And, you know, money's money. And during that period of time, they were making decisions they could.
And you're right. You know, $100 million in automotive terms is a drop in the bucket. But these days, $100
million
is $100 million. And it's better than just closing it down and getting nothing.
Yeah, that seems the Opel situation. It may still end up being GM's.
Boy,
that's
going. Exactly.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
If I'm GM's board or if I'm Fritz Henderson, I'm looking at the Saturn situation and I'm saying, okay, I'm going to give this great retailer my great retail network, and who knows what he's going to bring in. Maybe he brings in cars from China or from Mahindra or Tata from India, and suddenly you knock down a big barrier to entry for a player with low cost to come into the U.S. market. You know, and let's face it, you know, GM's brands, you know, especially Chevrolet, you know, they're trying, at least with the passenger car business, they're trying to come back and prove that they're as good as the Japanese and better than the Koreans and this sort of thing. And they're going to be competing at some level with whoever Roger might bring in. I just don't see the money that they would get out of this. You know, I asked Fritz Henderson the question. He said this was about doing, you know, basically doing right by the Saturn dealers. And I said, what about the competition? He said, we're not going to make it easy for them. But you're still creating more competition, or at least you may be opening the door for more competition.
Easier. Maybe you made it a little easier. The competition is coming either way.
So do you think GM has more to lose?
I think in the long term, this could come back. I mean, depending on what Roger sells in those showrooms, it could come back to haunt him. If this is a great retail network for Geely or Mahindra and Mahindra or Tata or somebody like that, and, you know, they've got the retail issue knocked down and with a sterling operator to boot, I think it could really come back to haunt him.
Except that I'd point out, yeah, the Saturn points are fabulous, run by people who really know the retail business.
Yeah.
The Saturn lineup, up until about this whole mess started, I would argue is one of the most handsome lineups in the business right now. They knocked their brains out on this thing, and they hit, 180,000 units a year ago or something like that before the market collapsed. I mean, that's not even one assembly plant worth of production.
Right.
With the best
at it. I'm not saying they should have kept it. I've been in this hobby horse before.
No, all I'm saying is that Roger may have a hard time working with this thing.
Yeah, Roger's got to backfill other stuff in there.
Oh, yeah.
Without question. And you're right. That other stuff may be a risk to GM, but I would suggest that other stuff was going to come in one way or the other and probably partly to do with Roger anyway. So, therefore, you might as well, you know, and again, Opel may end up being back in the GM fray at some point. There's some sourcing there. This world has a funny way.
If RHJ, the investment firm, got Opel, for sure it would end up in GM back at some point. But the fact that, you know, GM's only going to have 35% ownership. Sparebank and Gaz are in on this deal big time. As you know, Bo Anderson's now running Gaz, which I find fascinating. I'm not so sure they're going to get it back now.
They may not, but the point is that you, in this industry, you never know.
Never say never.
Well,
never
the European Commission is beginning to look at that. They may not let that deal go through.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
they've got to beat the drum and say, we got to protect. Well, what are they going to do? They're going to let the whole thing collapse?
What's
going to happen?
Look, if it is, but if it's a question of free trade and or fair economic agreements within the EU, that one government can't subsidize to save jobs at the expense of jobs in the UK and Spain and Belgium, and that's what the EU says, then that's what happens. Well, the UK is not going to be involved from an EU standpoint, but if they say the German government can't rescue this company to save jobs in Bochum and Eisenach, and then you're going to see jobs cut in other plants in Poland or Belgium or Spain, then, it could be an issue. Sure.
Right. And isn't the Astra plant going to be the one that's going to be shut down?
Well, they're talking about the plant in Belgium.
Yeah.
Is that the Astra plant?
Yeah.
I think the Astra's made in a variety of
plants. Two places, at least.
The one that we get, I thought, was from Belgium.
Well, I mean,
I don't know.
Opel will find some place to produce the car. I mean, capacity is just... That's not an issue for them.
The thing in Europe, right now, the discussion, I was there last week, is that they're concerned this is some sort of great sort of game where the Russians are going to now have access to German technology that they otherwise would never have been able to get their hands on for long periods of time. The indigenous Russian manufacturers are weak. They don't have the cash. They don't have the capital. They don't have the capability. And now, voila.
Issues over there, Tim?
Pardon?
Do they still have quality issues with those companies? They have for a while.
Well, they do. But, are they yet ready to play in the world stage? The answer is no.
Right.
They're getting better each year, but they're not ready to play. But now what you've got is Opel. And, as you said, first of all, the Saturn line, which had a lot of Opel roots, was a great-looking line. Opel's launching some great product now that was in the pipeline. And now the Russian auto industry can call that their own and migrate that technology. And what you're going to see is Russian Opel-like technology coming back across the border. So now we're going to create, or I guess the concern is in Europe, you're now going to really create a real Russian auto industry. And Opel's going to give them the tools.
See, this is the shame about GM selling Opel is that the Insignia is doing pretty well, and it's getting better pricing than they've gotten in that market before. I'm hearing good things about the Astra, Zafira, and I think the next Mareva are supposed to be pretty good. I mean, you may be getting rid of it just before the good stuff that they've been trying to do. Yeah. Now, you still have real serious issues with Opel, like a very high-cost manufacturing, and they haven't gotten the kind of pricing to justify that. I mean, you're talking about, very pedestrian levels of pricing on their cars and the highest labor cost you can have in Europe, and it just hasn't worked for them.
No.
But they got, they've got good product coming, I think.
They've got good engineering over there.
They do.
And so
they really do.
Wouldn't that
and
be?
It's good engine technology, too, which I mean, so there's a combination of things.
Right. Well, Opel's still going to need GM. They still need the volume that GM brings. But I got a question for you, Tim. As somebody who spent so much time in the supplier industry still there, what do you make of Magna coming in? And, Volkswagen's made no bones about it. They do not like a supplier of theirs becoming a competitor of theirs. What do you think of a supplier getting into the car business?
Well, I got to say, Dura's in grand coopetition with Magna. We supply them, they supply us, and we compete. We're checking all the boxes with them, so I'll try to be sensitive to what I say. I think I sensed when I was in Europe last week, and Volkswagen is probably at the top of that list, they all kind of are in that boat of being concerned about intellectual property. There's no question about it. But we know that Stronach has wanted to make cars or be in that end of the business for a long time. And if you ever want to do it in his lifetime, it doesn't get any cheaper than now. So will it cost Magna some supply business? Answer is it clearly will. But the question is, what's the trade-off? And this has been a lifelong dream he's had. So,
do you remember when they showed the Torero? Do you remember that?
I do remember.
Yeah.
That was about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Where Magna designed its own vehicle, showed it at the SAE convention, as I remember.
Said, we can make all these parts, and we've got them all.
Well, they did a concept car probably whenever Mark Hogan was still there, maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
I remember that too.
It was it was a pretty cool looking orange car. Wasn't it like a hydrogen fuel cell or it was an electric car? Mm-hmm. You know, it was something kind of high tech, and you know they were, you know, this was sort of a showcase to tell people what they could do because they wanted to, at that point they were really pushing contract manufacturing.
Right. Well, they liked that, but again, remember when Republic was starting to, you know, to get legs and be a major retail outlet and all this, they were saying, well, we can make generic cars. You know, the brand isn't necessarily before GM or Chrysler can be, you know, the retail brand. So, I mean, they've been wanting to play in that space a long time. If you want to play, auto companies are as cheap as they're going to get.
Right. That's a great point. And, you know, to your point of them having built a car in the past, anybody can build a one-off. I mean, literally anybody.
I know, but right. They were
another
also
thing to put it in production.
But they were assembling Chryslers and Mercedes cars in Graz.
That's
and,
true.
They were trying to find some business here. They were even scouting locations for a plant in the U.S. at one point, and then things got bad. And
well, look, the problems that they've run into in the U.S., they wanted to man. Oh, hey, look, we got the Torero up there.
There it is. There it is.
That is pretty good. Wow.
That was ahead of its time.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, it was like an early sport ute.
Yeah. No kidding.
With a little bit of Bricklin.
I don't know. It's about that era.
Yeah.
Right.
It's got some Subaru
esque.
Yeah, what's that? You know,
the SVX is what you're thinking about, I think.
Well, that and it sort of looks like it has a pickup cap on the wagon part of it back there.
Or like the old chicken tax vehicle they got around with the chicken tax seats.
What was their El Camino kind of thing they had?
The Baja. With seats, it came with seats in the back.
Right, in the back, facing backward.
Yeah.
Like station wagons,
which is, you know, from a safety perspective.
Oh, you mean a Subaru?
Yeah.
That was the Brat.
The Brat.
Oh, the
no,
Brat.
But they had a Baja. He's right. They had a Baja that, you know, they sold sometime earlier in this decade that was sort of an El Camino-looking kind of thing. And I think
it was a legacy wagon with a bit of the back chopped off to give a bit of a bed that you couldn't put anything in.
Yeah. A lot of those concept merging pickups with sedans, with SUVs.
But you remember to get it in, they had to put seats in the back.
Yeah, right.
And the chicken tax is alive and well. I saw with Ford bringing in
the Transit Connect. And they bring them into the state.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, there's the Baja. But I'm telling you, you know, as a mountain biker and a skier, neither my bike nor my skis fit in the back. You know, it was just small enough that nothing fit in there except maybe groceries. But
cooler.
They want it all covered up. So it was.
Well, and the two-tone thing they had with the yellow and the gray, they always showed that car everywhere, and it's horrible.
Right. It didn't work. I mean, you know, somebody in product planning said, hey, there's a big hole in the market that we can plug with the Baja, and it just never worked. What do you guys make of Fisker getting $500 million plus from the American government, this loan? Here's a company that's never built a car. You know, it goes back to my comment of anybody can build one. So they build this one-off prototype. They've never built a car in production. They're still a year away from building a car in production. When they do build it, they're going to build them in Finland. Government gives them $525 million.
Is Valmet doing it for them?
Valmet's assembled.
So they make Porsches, so they had that experience.
I think they lost the Porsche.
But Valmet.
But they've got experience.
They know how to make cars.
They know how to assemble, right.
But what I find to be interesting is the price point that, you know, Fisker is talking about, even for the less expensive car.
Right.
I mean, okay, I can't.
Well, they're talking $40,000.
They want to sell 100,000 of those.
Right. So.
You know, I can tell you this.
Yeah.
The auto industry still has such a bad reputation in Washington that they actually believe people who come in and say, I can do a better deal, who have no experience, no retail network. No longevity in this market, because the issue is not, as you say, you can build one, but you got to build lots of them that roll over and don't hurt the occupants. That if there's a fire, you know, there's certain controls on the combustibles. I mean, there's all the kinds of things you've got to do. And if it was that easy, people would be jumping this business left, right, and center. The government just took our dollars. And my concern is just blown $525 million.
That's my opinion exactly. You know, I hope I'm wrong, but I just don't have any confidence they're going to pull this off.
You know, on one hand, if you want plug-in hybrids and electric cars and you want to see more companies doing it, you want the technology to develop, the market's not going to be created in the open free market. Consumers, you know, can't afford these things at the prices that they're being sold right now. So you're not going to get any volume. So if government's going to cede technology, yeah, that can be a good thing. But in this case, the red flag for me is they've raised $100 million in private capital from the true believers who think that plug-in hybrids and electric cars are the thing. And those people weren't, you know, they tried to raise, I think, another $80 million, I was told, and they couldn't get it done. And that tells you that the true believers aren't putting up any more money. So they go to the government, and the government gives five times the equity of the company in public loan dollars. So, and now Tesla has raised a lot more. They're well over 300 now. I think like $320 million they've raised privately. But they still, the amount of government funding they're getting is well in excess of the private capital from, again, the true believers, the people who, you know, want to, you know, see electric cars on the roads all over the place and who believe in the executives of these companies and the engineers there. The people believe won't put in enough money to make it a go, so they go to the public, and the public ponies up a lot more, gambling a lot more dollars on this thing. Yeah, I don't like it either. I mean, if the private capital were going to match even dollar for dollar, yeah, I'd be a little more inclined to say okay. But
of course, in the last 12 months, many of those true believers lost their vast wealth,
but
the ability to
making a reliable automobile that covers the winter, the summer, the rain, the durability, the potholes, the reliability over time is not an easy undertaking. And we have seen many people try. And especially now that you're going to go into a whole new different technology. It's bad enough just doing an IC engine with a conventional transmission and et cetera, et cetera. To go off on this technology, it is highly unlikely. If we're talking, I think there's a better chance of betting on the lottery.
Right. I was sort of amused today, too. The story came out. I don't know if you guys knew Mike Donohue. That was at Chrysler, who went to Tesla and resigned or got fired. I'm not sure what the story is yet, but I found it amusing that, you know, Tesla now is not just going to take rollers from Lotus and gut them and put in batteries and electric motors. They're going to build their whole own car.
The Model S is
Model
up
S. And so they say, just as they're getting ready to start looking around for plants and get into serious volume production. What are they talking about, 50,000 or something of the Model S's?
I thought it was
like
20,
that.
But it's...
Okay, maybe it's whatever it is.
It's much more than they've ever done.
So their expert in engineering and manufacturing is gone. And Elon Musk is quoted as saying, well, it was a logical time for Mike to move.
And he's only there a year and a half.
I know. Just as you're getting ready to take this big project, you get rid of the experience that you have. To me, there's a lot more to this story.
But it was interesting. I talked to Mike at the Detroit show, and we sat down and talked because I've known him for a long time. And, you know, he really seemed to think it was, this is just engineering cars. You know, he said, it's the same problem we had when we were at Chrysler engineering things, and it's just a different powertrain, but we still have the same HVAC things we have to deal with. We have the same suspension issues we have to deal with. We've still got, you know, the rollover issues we have to deal with. And he made it seem so very matter-of-fact and not as though he were involved in some great undertaking to develop some new technology that was going to completely transform the auto industry as we've come to know it.
Well, there's definitely more to the story because you look at Tesla. You know, Martin Eberhard was the first CEO of the company, and he and Musk were at loggerheads. I think there may still be a lawsuit between them right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then Musk brought in an interim chairman named Michael Marks, who kind of did help them get the cost down for the Roadster and kind of righted the ship a bit. And then, but he was only interim, and then there was a guy, I can't remember his name actually, an Israeli guy who was ran the company for a while, and then Musk decided he was going to take the thing over himself. So you've gone through essentially four CEOs in the 5 or 6 years that the company's been around. Their head of marketing left a year or two ago. Now you got Donohue comes in, leaves pretty quickly. You know, and this is a company that's gotten nearly $500 million in government funds as well, and, you know, they're going through men like Sherman to the sea here. You know? High turnover in upper management for a company that's, you know, supposedly pushing a great technology and you know, going to get all this public money to put more of these electric cars on the road. Not a good time.
Tim, as somebody in the supplier industry, would you invest a lot in producing electric vehicle componentry? Do you think these things are going to catch on?
I don't. I mean, I think you still try to do the math, and you still try to make sense of the electric vehicle. I think, in my mind, the hybrid is still probably a bridge if there is one. But again, we get a lot better with even conventional product. The challenge we have is you need an energy policy so you know what the price of fuel is. Once you know what the price of fuel is, then you can start making vehicle fleet decisions. At $4 to $5 a gallon, we're going to be able to sell a lot more four-cylinder engines and get CAFE to work. At $2.50 a gallon, you're going to have to sell a lot of exotics to help get yourself down to some sort of CAFE number. I mean, that's part of the problem. Washington can set any target they want, but it starts with what is the price of fuel?
Right, but the only way you get there is with taxes, right? At least right now.
Yeah.
Because
the rest of the way the rest of the world does it, but it's really a problem
right.
here.
But you know, we the American people will throw anybody out of office that dares to raise our gas tax.
Yeah, it is the challenge. But I will tell you this: I mean, look at diesels. I mean, some of the diesels that are coming in, superb vehicles, the hybrids. You know, as again, you know, and I preached this before. Long term, I see a hydrogen future. How we get there, I don't know. But electrics by themselves, the Chevy Volt, if there's going to be a plug-in electric vehicle that is probably as good as anything on earth, it'll be the Chevy Volt. And they're still going to have a tough time selling it at the price point they've talked about, and that's okay because they can't make that many of them.
Mm-hmm. and what happens if gas stays at $2.50?
It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough.
Do you think that people, I mean, in fairness to Tesla here, I mean, I think they do make a good case that they're, even their sedan is going to be sort of an exotic. And, I mean, do you think these kind of cars are really dependent on gas prices? I mean, somebody buying certainly a Roadster, but even a $50,000 Tesla sedan.
I mean, lovely vehicle, let's say. But outside of...
But the people buying that $50,000 electric car, they don't care about gas prices. That's not why they're buying it. They're making a statement or they want something that's unique.
And the performance is impressive.
I mean, I've driven the Tesla Roadster.
Cool.
Yeah, the Tesla Roadster is,
blistering.
How many vehicles do you need to make to really get a good return? Because what's going to happen is every time these guys launch a vehicle company, they forget that little thing called, I think I got to discount these puppies to move them, or I've got some warranty costs that were above plan, or my dealers want a little bit more spiff because, you know, and pretty the economic model of being a very low volume manufacturer, after you get past the Hollywood starlets and the T-shirts that want to buy it and show up at the Oscars and all that group, and you get to the real real buyers,
right.
It's a tough group.
It is. Well, and the other problem they're going to have, and this isn't just Tesla, it's Fisker, and it's, what's the other company, Coda, you know, that they all want to have an electric car out 2010-11 time frame, and one that's going to be higher volume, not just a Roadster. You know, they've sold 700 of those so far, but you're going to have a Chevy Volt, you're going to have a Nissan Leaf. You'll have a plug-in version of a Prius.
Tough.
Yeah. Is an electric Tesla or an electric Fisker that much, in terms of making a green statement, does it make that much bigger of a statement than a Chevy Volt or a plug-in Prius or something like that?
Yeah.
Well, I see instant overcapacity in the EV market.
Yeah, I do.
You know, and just Nissan alone is going to have excess capacity. And then Renault is getting into it. They're talking about 3 manufacturing spots, U.S.,
correct.
Japan, Europe. You know, Ford's coming out with electrics. Chrysler, you know, they've talked about it. We'll see. I'm with you, Tim. You know, it's going to be a small market to begin with, and everybody's throwing manufacturing capacity at this thing. I think we're going to have massive overcapacity in electrics in a very short amount of time.
Do you think electrics are third cars for people?
It depends where you live and your lifestyle. I mean, it's just like the smart car. If you're commuting 10 to 15 miles to work and you're in certain climates, it's probably not an issue. If you're sitting on the LA freeway, it's a different story. If you live in Brighton and you're working downtown for, you know, GM, that's a bit of a haul. And the problem, and again, the U.S., because gas was so cheap, if you look at our average commute, it's not like Europe or Japan. And where there are large commutes in Europe or Japan, it's
by train.
It's by train.
Or bus.
It's some other, you know, light rail or something else. So we've got a kind of a unique situation where there's a lot of large commutes. But if you got that particular package that works, that's fine.
Could it be, though, that we might see export out of this country of electric cars? Would that work? Is the dollar getting down low enough, Tim, where we can
what are we at, 147 in the euro? The U.S. is now a low-cost country.
Right.
Hyundai always talks about the fact that it's like $5 an hour cheaper to build cars in the States than it is in Ulsan. I mean, we've gotten to the point where we are a low-cost country because of exchange, so that may help a bit. But again, the market's not there either in the rest of the world. It's a pretty expensive vehicle.
I was interested to see this week Nissan announced it's going to export V8 engines from the U.S. to Japan. Honda announced it's going to build Civics in America and export them to Latin America. Mercedes announced it's moving C-car production to the United States. So are we going to be able to export?
Well, we can. I mean, today, I mean, you know, you see our classes and you see other Mercedes on the roads of Europe that were produced down in Alabama. I mean, it's happening. But right now with the currency, Europe is a really expensive place. And if you're selling, especially in the lower end of the European car market, you'd like to make them someplace else because at 147 euros, that's where we're at. And you keep saying, well, what's going to happen to the dollar? With all the budget deficits, we're probably going to have inflation and maybe, you know, how that's going to affect the dollar. Right now, the dollar looks, vis-a-vis the euro, for a longer period of time, to be a pretty cheap currency.
You ever see the big three exporting out of this market? I mean, I know they do little bits and pieces, but...
Well, they do for vehicles that work. You know, the rest of the world's not standing in line for Chrysler 300, Suburbans, and F-150s. And we end up making a large number of vehicles that the rest of the world just can't handle. But Jeeps have been exported. And so I think, you know, we'll see more of that.
So do you think if more small cars are manufactured in the United States that they would have a greater possibility of being received in other markets and as a good deal?
Well, without question. I mean, you know, because we are economic animals. We would have sat here 20 years ago and said, you know, BMW building a plant in the States, or, I mean, all, you know, impossible. Here we are today. That's where we're at. And if the dollar stays weak, I mean, companies now who have multiple manufacturing locations globally do that all the time. Honda Fits kind of go from China to Europe and all over, and it's going to happen because it's just an economic issue.
Mm-hmm. So it's an issue of what type of vehicle is being produced here.
You can't sell, you know, Crown Vics and F-150s. And if you look at the array of vehicles historically that the U.S. built, they're, again, because of energy policy, we're kind of unique to America. No one else, maybe people wanted them, but they couldn't afford them. But if we move to a more fuel-efficient vehicle, a more globally acceptable vehicle, this is one of the most lowest-cost locations on Earth to build them because of currency and the new facilities, especially ones in the South with the work rules, et cetera.
But that won't exist forever, will it? I mean,
it won't exist forever. I mean, but it's there's such an indigenous market here, you play both sides. I need it for the local market, and I can do a little export. And it's like Mercedes. Mercedes can source from here, not source from here. They can mix, and they will do so.
It's got to be really tough for BMW and Mercedes to make money on the cars they're building in Europe and selling over here right now. I mean, they've really got to be hurting.
It's a Jaguar also. I mean, even though it's the pound, it's tough. I mean, it's for two reasons. One, the costs are out of line because of exchange, but also the volumes are down. I mean, if you look at, we're starting to see legs back in the European market, but it's BMW 3 Series, and it's, you know, the low end. It's not 7 Series. It's not S-Classes.
Throw shipping costs in there, and
it becomes real money.
Well, that's what happened to the Pontiac G8, right? They couldn't justify, they couldn't make a business case. It was part
of the value of the Australian dollar doubled, you know, in the last decade.
Yeah.
You know, I was there a decade ago. It was 50 cents on the dollar. Now it's parity, maybe even ahead of the U.S. dollar.
But Australia has always been one of those unique situations where they've always said the only way to make sense of this is an export market. To where?
New Zealand.
Yeah, that's always been the issue.
Hey, what did you make? Ford came out, or Alan Mulally was quoted as saying, he says sales are going to hit in the U.S. market 11 million units this year. And I think we're still running at about a 10.3.
Mm-hmm. So J.D. Power said today 10.3 they still predict.
Yeah. 10.3, but and then Mulally was saying 12.5 million next year and 14.5 million in 2011. As you look out for Dura here into the future, where do you see?
God love him.
Yeah. From his lips to God's ears.
Yes. I mean, you know, two things. One, the supplier industry and the manufacturing industry was running at about 8% below that because we cleaned up about 1 million units out of inventory, plus or minus. So what happened is just to run next year at this year's sales rate will be good news for the supplier industry because we basically shut down the first large part of the year because they were just selling vehicles out of inventory. So internally, what are we looking at? We're looking at 10.3, 10.4 next year. We're looking at Europe falling 9%.
Whoa.
Europe has had a lot of the clunker kind of programs called a variety of things, but they've kind of run out of steam. And the European economy is as troubled and as challenged as ours. And instead of having one guy trying to put it all together, you've got many different countries and many different programs. Spain and the UK particularly hard hit. And so the general feeling is it's going to be tough. And when it does come back in Europe, it's on the low end. It's Renault Logans and it's, you know, that end. It's not the good stuff. So Europe, we see the industry, and Asia is about flat next year. So we see the industry worldwide as being another tough year. Hopefully we're wrong.
But a little bit better because now you're not working out of inventory.
That's right. At least you're building at sales rate, which by itself is a good thing.
And you see the U.S. market then leading out of this recession.
We do, but there's a lot of variables.
Yeah.
There's a lot of
variables. And it depends who you're compared to because China is rocking right now.
It is really rocking and rolling. We're expanding in China. For that very reason. It's just that market, the indigenous market is going to be the story of the next 10 years.
Who do you have to partner with in China?
As a supplier, you don't have to partner with anyone any longer.
Really? You can just build? Okay.
Yeah. Up until about the mid-'80s, you really had to partner either legally or even if it wasn't legally, just to get the business done. But today you can go in, especially, and I'll tell you an interesting scenario. China wants to get on the world stage so quickly that they can't get the Chinese supply base up quality and cost as aggressive as they need. So what they're doing is they're reaching out to global suppliers. So the global suppliers are moving in, opening their own facilities, just like we did in Korea. So
do you think that there'll be sufficient demand within China itself as its middle class grows to absorb these vehicles, or will they be looking to export the vehicles?
There's going to be a lot of overcapacity in China because everyone's drinking from the same Kool-Aid bowl. You know, so
isn't there already overcapacity there? I mean, wasn't there even before the downturn there was overcapacity there. I mean, I've been reading analyst reports for several years now that even while sales were growing, prices were falling because there was so many plants coming online.
Yeah, no, China, it's like it's every economic model we've seen. Japan had to do it, Korea had to do it, we had to do it back in the old days. You know, the old days,
Brazil,
the toys of the 30s.
Right?
Brazil did it. China's going to do it. The only trouble is that China is a big company, a big country when it does it. So it's not going to need to export 1 million or 2 million vehicles. They'll be at the point where they're going to want to export 5 to 6 to 7 million vehicles by the end of this, you know, say by the middle of next decade. Where are they going to go?
Yeah, I was going to say what.
You know, I mean, it's going to be that China is not Japan or Korea. Take three. Oh, it's got its own
culturally. How are they going to accept layoffs when this stuff starts to happen?
That's when the Civil War starts.
Well, right now Japan is having a tough time with that. I mean, as you looked at the supply base trying to react globally, it's the Japanese that have been some of the biggest challenge. Because
did Asahi Tech have to lay off when you were with the company?
Well, we had Brazilians. And if you know Brazilians, in essence what they are is they're Japanese that came from Brazil. They're called temporary workers, and you flexed with these Brazilians. They looked like they were Japanese. They spoke Japanese. They acted like Japanese. But they were from Brazil, and they're brought in as part-time workers. Because there's a fairly large Japanese.
Yeah, no, I know. I didn't know that they were staffing with them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that was your flex. And historically, that was big enough to handle the dynamics. It's nowhere near big enough today. Hmm. Of course, I've been gone from a Scientech for a couple of years, but that, I don't know how they're dealing with it now. But.
Well, it's interesting, too. The new party in power in Japan is talking about banning temporary workers because of this very thing that you're talking about. And Toyota flexed a whole lot more of them than you guys ever did.
Oh, yeah. Without flexibility.
The U.S., too, I think. They've got a fair number of temporary workers at their U.S. plants.
Hey, we ought to get to the rapid fire segment of the show. Ben, if you can bring the questions in and just to explain it to you, you know, these are going to be questions and comments that we've gotten from viewers watching us. Ben will run a graphic here, too, to kick the whole thing off. And we've got sort of a countdown. It almost looks like it is like a gas gauge on a car, and it keeps going down as the time goes by. With 15 seconds left, you'll hear this ticking, 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 and then when you hear the low fuel chime, you're out of time. So we try to keep these things moving along pretty quick. Ben, run the graphic there.
love the graphic.
I've got a question that came in early from one of our viewers, Pedro Fernandez, who knew that you're going to be on the show because I've been promoting this whole thing. And he's got a pretty good question here. He says, if OEM parts come from the same supplier, why is it that the quality of the Asian brands is better than the domestics? Does it come down to engineering, design, or how they're manufactured, or what? And it's true. I mean, the Toyotas, Hondas, and Nissans of the world who build cars in this country source a lot from the same suppliers.
They do. One of the things we see differently with the Asians is they freeze a design a lot, you know, longer before job one. So there's a lot less late-minute changes. And therefore, you're PPAPing something that you've got the designs honed, you've been through the development process. And getting out of these last-minute changes is a big deal.
And PPAP means getting it ready for production.
Getting it ready for production.
Yeah. I know years ago when Don Runkle was at Delphi, and they make batteries, and he was getting complaints from General Motors saying, hey, you know, we have this high failure rate with your batteries. And he says, look, I sell the same batteries to you guys and to Toyota, and I don't pick out the bad ones to give to you guys. And when they started to look into it, it was like, yeah, it's the exact same battery, but in the GM case, it had all this stuff around it under the engine compartment. The battery was getting a lot hotter. Mm-hmm. And so they would have more failures as a result. So I think you have to look at the total environment
total application.
Those parts
exactly right.
live in, and not just inspect the parts as they come off the line at the supplier and say that they're good enough.
That's interesting. The domestics haven't gotten it yet that they should have design freezes and keep them hard. I mean,
they do, but there's always that desire. So, you know, to make a last-minute change and get the vehicle, especially when there's the dynamics of the marketplace. And so, you know, we still see it.
What's interesting? Hyundai is happy to do last-minute design changes. In fact, they brag about it. They term this Hyundai speed. Now, it applies to more than just last-minute changes. It applies to the whole mentality that they take to running the company. But Hyundai makes design changes left, right, and backwards, and their quality has done nothing but go up.
And their quality discipline is very strong in Hyundai. It was interesting to talk about speed. We built a plant for them in Korea and decided to start in the U.S., get the line up in the U.S., hire the Koreans, bring them to the States. They lived in Indiana. They worked on the line. We got it ready, rented the Aleutian, the biggest plane on Earth, and a 747, and picked the line up and moved it to Korea and put it down in Ulsan, and it reopened in 2 weeks. I don't know of any domestic OEM where I could have done that. But we all sat down with Hyundai and said, that's the lowest risk because it was a new product, with new manufacturing process, with new people.
They moved an entire assembly line by plane?
By plane. The big Aleutian.
Yeah.
And
Russian
747,
one.
The
right.
big Russian Aleutian. And we did it in 2 weeks, but from bold up to running again in Korea. And, you know, I've seldom seen an OEM that would do that.
Was that a calculated risk they made by doing
it? We all did it together because we were saying, look, if we launch this off in Korea, new product, new technology, new people, new plant, there's too many news in a row. And what's the risk of that? Versus let's launch it.
Oh. Nissan found that out in Canton. They had quality issues the first couple of years.
So it worked, and it worked exceptionally well. We built a bank. We built a bank for 60 days, thinking it was going to take us that long to get up, and we were up in 2 weeks.
Okay, Scott in Cleveland. Hey, Scotty. He says, Ford introduced the next generation Super Duty. Do you like the new front end? Any of you see that?
Saw it. It's very trucky.
Mm-hmm. Very trucky. I think it's pretty good. In fact, it looks like the front end now looks more like that big steel block they always drop on the concrete in their TV ads. So, yeah,
For that segment, it's right on.
I think what's under the hood is more interesting with that new diesel that they're coming out with.
And it's their own diesel.
Their own diesel. You know, and it's not a diesel. It's a diesel.
Yeah. And I guess they had enough fights with Navistar, decided to do their own. And, it looks pretty good. Sounds pretty quiet, too.
Yeah, it is. Amazing.
It's an amazing engine.
Okay, here, let's see. We've got a comment from Metek. I have odds that the car companies are on TV less than in the 50s through the 70s. Anyone know for sure?
What's he asking?
I mean, you talking about ad budgets being cut? Or?
Yeah, maybe that's it.
Cars on TV shows?
I'm not
My
sure.
Mother, the car. Car 54, what are you?
If it's that way, that's probably true, because if cars don't start, there's no The one with the red light that went on the front of it.
Knight Rider.
Knight Rider. I don't see that kind of stuff anymore. But if it's talking about ad budgets, I mean, ad budgets have been cut significantly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, huge. They're just starting to come back.
Yeah.
Okay, a comment from Wright Knight, who says, can Cadillac truly be planning a front-wheel drive replacement for a rear-wheel drive model positioned above the CTS? And can this truly work?
Yes. Well, it's basically, from what I've been told, it's going to be in a front-drive-based all-wheel-drive model.
You're talking about the replacement for the DTS, what
right.
used to be called the DeVille.
I think that's what he's talking about, right?
That's what I'm guessing.
And I've heard XTS, I think, might be a code name for it internally. I don't know if that will be the marketing name, but yeah, why not? I mean, if it is all-wheel-drive, I think we may have talked about this in the past episode, but the trick will be, if you want to sell in the luxury market, really getting rear-wheel drive design proportions in the car, if you really want to compete up in that sort of, you know, 5 Series E-Class / 7 S-Class segment with a big sedan, you can't have the long overhang of a front-drive car.
Well, Audi
got to have good proportions.
Audi started as a front-wheel drive vehicle,
yep. and they
become an all-wheel drive.
But they spend the money to engineer so they can get good rear-wheel drive proportions with those all-wheel drive cars.
Oh, very tight. Yep, packages.
Yeah. Okay, we've got a phone call, though. It's in about the new Hyundai Sonata. Can we hear that, Ben? Can you patch that in?
Yes, I just wondered if any of the gentlemen there, what they think of the new 011 Hyundai Sonata. I just wonder if they've seen any of the new ads that they have in Korea now for the new Sonata. Okay, I like watching your show. Thanks a lot. I'm from Pennsylvania. My name's Larry.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for the question. I think the new Sonata is dramatic. It is dramatically different. In fact, it looks more like a Lexus than a Hyundai.
They went Honda Accord to Lexus in their design bogey. Mm-hmm. I like almost everything Hyundai does. I mean, I think they're a great company. They're ran by engineers. They've got a great feel. They got a great taste for the market. 25 years ago, they made 50,000 cars a year. Now they're making 3.5-4 million vehicles because they don't do that because people don't like them. They make great product.
Yeah, what's scary about the Koreans is if you look at cars like Sonata, the Genesis, the Kia Soul, you know, they've been making some pretty nice appliances for the past few years, but now they're starting to figure out design. And it's not, you know, often when companies have been making bland product, their first few cars are sort of, they're aggressive but awkward. They're making some tasteful
designs.
Well, two key things.
Really
they went and stole two great designers.
That's right.
They stole Joel Piskowski away from General Motors.
He left,
who
right?
Mercedes stole away from them. Then they, Hyundai went, or Kia, I should say,
they
stole Peter Schreyer from Audi.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, they got great design.
Okay, I think the Soul is a great looking car.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Unsprung wants to know, is Penske going to sell the Sky / Opel GT? My guess is no.
I think that vehicle's dead. My understanding is the vehicle's dead.
Sure it is.
Because that's
They're
built
closing that plant, right?
That
yeah.
plant's in Delaware?
Wilmington, yeah.
Yeah, Wilmington,
yeah.
Delaware.
That
done gone away, right. Bill Bowen says, I can see Gaz taking the Opel technology and going head-to-head with GM in China.
No, they're precluded from doing that until, I think, 2015, something like that. There were when GM signed the deal, and I think, I don't know when they got these, but I think it was one of the things that may have made the board more comfortable with them. Not sure about the timeline of it, but anyways, they got restrictions going to various years in the U.S., Canada, China, and South Korea, South Korean market, too, on Opel.
Yeah.
So Europe will be the battleground, and that'll be quick.
Of course, you know, you say 2015, and it sounds like a long way away.
It's not. Yeah,
Two design cycles, and we're there, man. It's the blink of an eye in automotive.
One design and a refresh. I mean,
We've frozen in the 012, so, you know, there we are.
Michael Weber says, we don't care about F1, Formula One in the States, but has Renault's worldwide brand been damaged by the Briatore PK fiasco?
In Europe last week, it sure doesn't appear to be. You know, I mean, the biggest thing they've got is Alonso going to Ferrari. I mean, that's the issue. You know, forget the cheating. Forget what happened in Singapore. It's Alonso going to Ferrari.
I'm sure it's embarrassing for Carlos Ghosn, but I don't think it hurts Renault's brain.
I don't think so.
No.
A lot of people just don't care that much about racing. And,
Well, not in this country. F1 in Europe, it's a big
deal. But the point is that everyone cheats in F1. I mean, so therefore, you know.
Some are a little more sophisticated than others.
Some are more sophisticated than others.
But okay, but if Brian's getting caught.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so NASCAR is big in the U.S., and if Ford were cheating, would someone say, geez, I was looking at a Fusion, but I'm going to go look at the Sonata now because the NASCAR team was cheating?
No, they'd say, God damn, they've been cheating. Now that's my kind of race team.
You're going to get letters.
Jeremy Jones wants to know, has there been any more developments in supercapacitors?
Well, I was talking to a guy for ultracapacitors. I don't know if he...
I think that's probably the same as that. Ultra, but, supercapacitor, right?
Yeah, they seem to be indicating that there is some traction making very small ultracapacitors for a variety of applications that are like transient loads. Mm-hmm. So it could be moving your seats back and forth or your windows up and down, because they're saying that, you know, as you're having these increased loads on the electrical system, that, you know, being able to have this fast discharge and fast recharge has great possibilities. But I guess it's all this issue of shrinking it and the cost issue. Very expensive still, so.
MudMonster37's got a great one. He says, when you heard that Fiat wants to make Chrysler a competitor to Cadillac, did you look out your window to see pigs fly? What do you guys make of that?
Well, I'll tell you, from a product standpoint, the next generation 300 is a stunner. And it really is, you know, depending on how they're going to equip it, but it really could be a luxury car. It's, you know, stately. It's got a, you know, a bit brash, but very stately. But the brand isn't there. It's sort of like saying the Genesis is a luxury car. It's you know, it looks and drives and feels like one, but the brand isn't luxury, and that's what luxury people buy.
But again, where was Lexus 20 years ago?
I mean, the question is, I know, but they were marketing it as a luxury car. Chrysler's
got to reposition the brand.
There's baggage that Chrysler's got to get.
Lexus came from nothing.
Well, starting off saying this is luxury and making luxury cars is one thing.
So if we take that 300, call it a Chrysler Imperial LeBaron, put a lot of chrome on it, that pig's still going to be flying, I guess. Yeah. I mean, it's going to take a while to reposition the brand, but there's no question the product's good. Lincoln and Cadillac aren't exactly overlapping. You know? So maybe there's room.
I think Cadillac's the only legitimate American luxury brand at the moment. I mean, Lincoln's got some good product, but I think they're, you know, sort of in the premium/luxury segment.
Yeah.
Okay, Espo wants to know, will GM get back into the compact pickup market, or will they just give it to Mahindra?
Ooh, that's a really good question.
That's a good question, right, because Mahindra's got... they're going to have a cheap price.
They are.
But, I mean, the truck is going to be a truck.
It's a basic vehicle. Yeah.
It's a pretty basic thing.
Probably wishes it had the Ranger.
I guess the issue is, how big is that segment?
It's a tough segment.
There's some decent volume to be had there. I mean, you can fill a plant with that, you know, if you're Chevy, right? Chevy GMC?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. You know,
the only one who does well there up until recently has been Toyota with the Tacoma, and they put a lot of effort in.
Nissan's done all right with Frontier in that segment.
Yeah, but at one point, Toyota had like 25% of the market just itself, and that, you know, just astonishing.
Okay, Drewson wants to know, has anyone seen the Ford India car, the Figo?
Yeah, it's a freshening.
Of an old Fiesta?
An old Fiesta. But you got the high, you know, roof line, which is what you need in India. It's got some interesting cues. Ford is very high on that. It'll be interesting to see what they do. I mean, that market, the problem with the Indian market is it's occurring and expanding when China's getting sucking all the air out of the room, you know, and then sometimes forget about India. But it's starting to get traction. And that vehicle looks a heck of a lot better than the old Fiesta.
Yeah. And, you know, India's got over 1 billion people. It could develop into a significant market.
It's got over 1 billion people and still has the same amount of roads it did in 1947.
Well, I had this conversation with Rick Wagoner when he was still at GM, and it wasn't, you know, I think it was last year, and I asked him about the Indian market. He goes, I can build you and sell you the cars, but there really aren't any roads. That's the problem.
Infrastructure remains the issue in India,
Which is amazing, because there's a lot of money going into the economy there that they haven't been able to really upgrade the roads.
Andrew Libera wants to know, we were told that Mercury was supposed to get a new small car by 2010, but we haven't seen any of it at the auto shows, and 2010's right around the corner. Has that vehicle been canceled?
I mean, Mercury's still alive? I've heard that. Wait a minute. I can't remember what I heard now, to be honest with you, on a compact for Mercury.
I've heard nothing.
I think Lincoln's going to get some kind of small car.
Yeah, the Lincoln Mercury showroom will have it. It's probably going to be branded Lincoln.
I think you're right. I'm not even sure on that, but I don't think Mercury's going to get it. Why would you give it to both?
Yeah.
You get the same volume out of either brand, you get better pricing with Lincoln.
Well, they're trying it with the Milan and the MKZ.
Yeah, they need another effort, right? Michael Weber asks, how much do Chinese auto consumer preferences influence the cars we buy here in the States?
Do you see the door pulls on the new LaCrosse in the back seat?
No.
They have there's a cover you stick your hand through, so presumably so no debris falls on the top of your hand as you're pulling the door shut. And it's very nice leather, and it's puckered, and it's very Chinese.
Oh, that's true. They did that for the Chinese limo market.
Right. So that's the back seat is huge back there.
But for example, they stretch the STS in China.
Right.
For the Chinese market.
In fact, I think they call it the SDS there, something like that.
Some different variant. And Buick's got some unique sheet metal there. I mean, that Chinese market is affecting, obviously, the variants in China a lot more than it's affecting the designs of the U.S. product. But
I mean, Buick, you get some serious influence on the products here because I think they're...
Well, they sell more Buicks there than they do here.
Sure. So they're more cued into that market. I don't see it with other brands and other products that much, though.
You know, Cho En-Lai drove a Buick. And if you go through a lot of the historical Chinese pictures, that's Cho En-Lai and Buick, and that's why Buick is sort of part of their heritage.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was not a mistake that GM took that brand to China.
Very strong.
A lot of market research.
I think the Chinese wanted it.
Oh, they did, It's a big name in China. I mean, it goes back. I said Cho En-Lai, who's for many of the younger people, is as big as Mao, because Cho En-Lai was very supportive of the Chinese culture. Buick, and he's in a picture of Buick traveling around.
Wasn't there that Paris to Beijing race or something that happened in 19-aught something or other that Buick won and that, like, established the brand as being the...
But it is.
You know something about the market over there. Has Buick watered down the brand a little bit by doing things like Ossettis, which are essentially Daewoo cars and stuff like that from Korea?
They would if they did it here, but that was the only way to survive there. I mean, the point is that they were a bit like Mercedes. Did Mercedes water the brand down by doing E-classes and C-classes, I should say, you know?
Because I've read this on Chinese auto blogs where, you know, they're saying, well, you know, this isn't a real Buick. It's really a Chevy or a Daewoo, Korean car that's been rebadged over here.
Yeah, it hasn't, I think, tarnished that brand. It may be in the enthusiast, but for the mass market, not at all. Not at all. Not yet.
Okay, Matt Boshi wants to know, what is going on at GM? First, Lutz says the G8 will be brought back to North America as a Caprice, only to be stood up by Fritz saying no way. Then today, GM says they will do their annual September Chevrolet GMC truck sale after Lutz said last week that they were not going to participate this year because they wanted to focus on advertising the brands. Sounds like mass confusion down at the Rensen. What is one to think?
Maybe it's like that Seinfeld where George decides he's going to do the opposite of what George would do. So maybe this is the GM approach that they decide they're going to do something, then they do the opposite and hope that it works out well.
Well, I don't know about the truck sale of combination Chevrolet GMC, but they have agonized over the G8. I mean, they want that car so bad.
It's a good car.
It's a great car.
You know? I mean, but the point is, I'm sure here's the issue again: product versus economics. I mean, I got to tell you, they're not making a lot of money in that vehicle by the time they land in the States.
Right.
I don't care what you brand it at, as we discussed with Exchange.
Shouldn't there be a way to engineer that so that they could build it in Canada where they build the Camaro? I mean, aren't they modified versions of the same platform?
It's
the Zeta platform.
It's a Zeta platform.
How long would it take Honda to make two cars off a slightly different version of the same platform in the same plant? Why couldn't they make it there and get it here pretty quickly?
Well, because you're saying Honda, and it'd be like that meter that we're looking at here very quickly.
Well, we did a live webcast with Tom Stevens on Monday, and asked him all about the G8, and he said, look, it's not an engineering problem, it's not a manufacturing problem, it's a business decision.
Because I raised
the exact same thing you did. Zeta in Oshawa, you build the Camaro, why not that? And he made it pretty clear, they haven't They haven't shut the door.
Well, I don't think they have. I think we're going to see it come back.
Because it's too good a car.
Yeah, and some of the issues are that they don't have, they sell the car as a Chevy Caprice, I think, in the Middle East. And it's not just a matter of slapping a front grille on it. They haven't, there's more significant redesign and crash testing, I think, that needs to be done to put a whole Chevy front end and really make it look like a Chevy. And they don't want to just badge engineer it either. I think it's coming back. And someone at GM told me that, you know, they need some time to cleanse the palate a bit with the public. But I think you'll see the GA come back as a Chevy.
But you got cafe regs coming, and you got a Cadillac brand that wants to expand its footprint. So there, how many V8s, how many large vehicle platforms can you live with and still make these numbers? You know, especially at $2.50 a gallon, so your consumer mix is going to be skewed to that side. So, I mean, all those issues get into the decision. It's not like the old days when you didn't have to worry about that.
It's an interesting question you bring up, because even though CAFE weighs heavily on everybody, all I'm hearing about are sport versions of this and, you know, more V8 cars coming. I mean, you know, every day I open the paper, there's another sports car, a sports sedan of some kind that's coming. And GM's talking about a lot of them. And you know, they don't have a lot of capital with CAFE because they sell a lot of trucks. I mean, you know, I personally think that CAFE is easier for these guys to meet than they are publicly saying. I think there's still a lot of loopholes in it, and I think the 35 MPG, which is done under the old fuel economy measurement, is really, if you believe Edmunds.com, and I think they're right about this, is really about 29 by mid-decade, and then there are some loopholes and ways to, you know, it's going to improve fuel economy, but I don't think it means the death of luxury cars or sports cars or anything like that.
You may be right, but I predict that it will be difficult, and if they have to start squeezing down the popular cars that people want, the prices of them are going to skyrocket.
Oh.
I mean, skyrocket.
Well,
101, business 101.
It's true. I mean, in you know, they're going to get better pricing for them, and very big luxury SUVs and fast sports sedans and things like, you know, 5-series cars, and, you know, they're going to become luxury vehicles again instead of something that, you know, someone making $45,000 a year can easily get into on a cheap lease payment.
Well, in France right now, there's the eco tax. You know, the eco tax, a tax on the larger vehicles and a subsidy for the smaller ones. So it's another way to transfer income. But what it basically does is it's added price. You know, we've got a gas guzzler tax, but imagine a gas guzzler tax coming down to vehicles that have a 23 or 24 mile per gallon rating or higher. Now, oops, a lot more, or less, I should say, and a lot more vehicles now fall into the category that were not luxury, but they're going to get priced that way. And that's what's happening right now in Europe.
Hey, it's time to wrap this up. But Tim Louliette, thanks so much for coming on. It's been great
getting
all your insight and ideas on all this stuff. Gary Vassalash from Automotive Design and Production, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, John.
It's been great having you.
A lot of fun.
David Welch, Business Week, great having you as always.
Thanks, John.
Got to thank Awards for also having carried this. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Autoline Detroit. Great to find out updates and things like that. You can follow us on Twitter, too. We're at twitter.com/Autoline. When Peter DeLorenzo is here, you can follow him at twitter.com/AutoExtremist. You can follow David Welch at
Businessweek.com.
Businessweek.com.
Yeah.
Gary, you guys got anything?
Yeah, AutoFieldGuide.com.
AutoFieldGuide.com. Tim, how about, what is it, Dura.com or something?
DuraAuto.com.
There you go. Makes it real easy. Well, thanks, everybody, for having tuned in. Really appreciate it. Another great episode of AutoLine After Hours. Visit our website, AutoLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutoLineDetroit.tv.